This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. So welcome to a custom deep dive. Today, we're looking at a massive stack of sources. We've got official Series 7 prep materials, thousands of pages of IRS tax codes, and decades of historical bond market data. Our mission today is to just completely conquer corporate bonds.
And we really need to frame the stakes right out of the gate here.
Yeah.
This topic, I mean, it is a massive chunk of the exam.
Huge.
It falls under Function 3, which is the heavily tested core of your exam. You cannot just memorize a stack of flashcards for this and expect to pass.
Yeah.
You have to deeply understand the mechanics.
Right.
Like the actual levers pulling behind the scenes. Mm. Because if you don't, you won't survive the trick questions they're going to throw at you.
I completely agree. And because standard, you know, dry finance lectures are the easiest way to lose focus, we are absolutely not doing that today. We're going to bring this to life. Throughout this whole deep dive, we're going to follow a recurring cast of characters so you can actually visualize these concepts, you know, in the real world.
The little narrative structure.
Exactly. So first up, we have Corporate Carl.
Oh, boy.
Carl is a chaotic, just wildly ambitious CEO who will try absolutely anything to raise debt for his ridiculous business ideas.
Right.
His current venture is a national chain of AI-powered drive-through sushi car washes.
Which is a fundamentally terrible business model.
Oh, it's awful.
I mean, you're combining heavy machinery, hot wax, and raw yellowtail.
Yeah.
But he desperately needs capital to build it.
So much capital. So on the other side of the table, we have investor Ingrid. Ingrid is a very strict, rule-abiding institutional fund manager. She manages billions in pension money, but she is bound by intense ironclad regulations on what she can and cannot buy. Mm-hmm. She has a fiduciary duty and a very thick compliance manual.
Right.
And finally, we have desperate Dave. Dave is a retail investor. He is constantly chasing high yield. He absolutely hates paying taxes. And frankly, he is going to fall for every single exam trap we cover today.
He really is. It's the perfect ecosystem to understand the corporate bond market, though. Because at its core, the bond market is just this ongoing, complex negotiation between a borrower who needs cash to buy sushi and scrubbers, like Carl.
Yeah.
And lenders who need a specific type of return, like Ingrid and Dave.
Exactly. So the story begins with the foundation. Corporate Carl needs cash. The banks won't touch him, obviously, so he decides to issue a corporate bond. Now, I know a bond is just a giant IOU, but let's break down the actual structural reality of this instrument.
Right. So structurally, a corporate bond is a debt instrument where the investor is lending money to the corporation for a set period of time. Let's detail the absolute basics you just must have locked in for the exam.
Okay.
The par value, which is also known as face value or principal, is universally $1,000 per bond.
Always 1,000.
Always. That is the baseline. They pay interest semi-annually, meaning every 6 months.
Hmm.
And for settlement, like when Dave eventually buys or sells one of Carl's corporate bonds in the secondary market, it settles T plus one.
Ah.
That is trade date plus one business day.
I always picture settlement like this. Dave hits buy on his brokerage app on a Monday. The trade executes. But the actual swap of Dave's cash for Carl's bond, the final clearing of the transaction, happens on Tuesday, T plus one.
Exactly.
And the bond itself isn't a physical piece of paper anymore, right? I'm assuming Dave doesn't get a fancy certificate in the mail.
No, everything is in book entry form now.
Right.
There are no physical bearer bonds anymore.
Yeah.
You don't get a heavy parchment document with little clip-off coupons to keep in a safe deposit box.
Right.
It is all electronically registered on servers.
Got it.
If an exam question mentions bearer bonds or physical delivery of corporate bonds, I want alarm bells going off in your head.
It's a trap.
It is almost certainly a distractor answer.
Okay, here is a direct question for you, the listener. Think about this for a second. Bond quotes in the real world and on the exam are always quoted as a percentage of par. So if Corporate Carl's bond is quoted on the screen at 102, how much is Desperate Dave actually paying out of pocket for that single bond? Take a beat and do the math.
Give him a second.
Okay, got it. He is paying $1,020. A quote of 102 means 102% of the $1,000 par value.
Right.
The shortcut here is to just not overthink it. Move the decimal one place to the right or just multiply the quote by 10. A quote of 98.5 is $985. It seems simple, But in a high-stress testing environment, people freeze on that math.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That conversion definitely needs to be second nature. Now, Carl is raising millions of dollars from thousands of different Daves and Ingrids.
Right.
He can't just print these digital IOUs and make up the rules as he goes. This brings us to the actual rulebook, which is formally known as the bond indenture. The indenture is the dense legal contract between Carl's company and the bondholders.
But Dave isn't, like, sitting down with Carl's lawyers to negotiate his $1,000 bond. That would be chaos.
Exactly. Because there are thousands of bondholders, they don't negotiate individually. Instead, they are represented by a single entity called a trustee.
Ah, the trustee.
Right. This structure is legally required under the Trust Indenture Act of 1939 for all public corporate bond issues over $10 million.
Well, I always think of the trustee like a very strict referee in a football game.
Oh, you like that?
Carl is the quarterback, right? He's trying to run his wild business plays, but the trustee is standing on the field with a whistle and the rule book. If the indenture says Carl has to maintain a $2 million cash reserve, and Carl decides to spend that reserve on a giant neon octopus sign for the car wash.
Which he would absolutely do.
Oh, 100%. The trustee just blows the whistle and throws the flag on behalf of all the bondholders.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The trustee enforces the covenants, the legal promises Carl made. But even with a referee on the field, Dave and Ingrid are taking on inherent risks by buying this bond.
Yeah.
And the core risks of any fixed income security operate like a seesaw. If you understand the seesaw, you can answer half the bond questions on the exam.
It's that important.
It really is. You have interest rate risk on one side and reinvestment risk on the other.
I want to really dig into this seesaw because I feel like this is exactly the kind of thing the test writers will use to set a trap.
Oh, yeah.
Let's say Dave buys Carl's bond paying a 4% coupon. A year later, the Federal Reserve changes policy and overall market interest rates go up.
Yeah.
New bonds are suddenly paying 6%. What happens to Dave?
Well, the price of Carl's existing 4% bond drops. That is interest rate risk. Nobody in the open market wants to buy Dave's old bond paying 4% when they can just buy a brand new one paying 6%.
Makes sense.
Right. So for Dave to sell his bond, he has to heavily discount the price. That is the negative side. Rising rates mean falling bond prices.
But a seesaw has two sides. Dave's price is dropping, which is terrible. But every 6 months, Carl is still sending Dave his semi-annual coupon payment. What does Dave do with that cash?
He reinvests it. And here's the silver lining. Because market rates have gone up, Dave now gets to reinvest his coupon payments into the new higher 6% environment.
Oh.
Right. So rising rates are bad for the bond's price, but good for Dave's reinvestment opportunities.
Okay, so if the Federal Reserve cuts rates, the seesaw tilts the opposite direction. Market rates fall to 2%. Dave's old 4% bond looks amazing now. Everyone wants it. So the price of Dave's bond spikes up. He is thrilled.
He is thrilled about the price, yes. But now when Carl sends Dave his semi-annual coupon, Dave has to take that cash and reinvest it in a market that is only paying 2%.
Oh.
His compounding power just took a huge hit. That is reinvestment risk.
Pattern interrupt. I want you to mentally lock in this inverse relationship. When rates rise, price drops. Reinvestment gets better. When rates fall, price spikes, reinvestment gets worse. The exam will give you a scenario and ask you to evaluate both sides of the coin. Don't let them trick you into thinking both risks move in the same direction.
Understanding that dynamic is critical.
Yeah.
But before Carl can even dream of selling these bonds to the public and dealing with interest rates, he has a massive existential hurdle to clear. The market needs an objective opinion on whether this AI sushi car wash is actually going to survive long enough to pay anyone back.
Enter the ratings agencies. I like to think of them as the bouncers manning the velvet rope of the financial world.
That is essentially what they are. The credit rating agencies, the big three being Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, they provide a standardized mathematical measure of default risk. They look at Carl's balance sheet, his cash flow projections, the macro environment, and they assign a letter grade indicating the statistical likelihood that Carl will make his interest and principal payments on time.
If I am writing the test, this is where I am setting a massive trap. Mm. What exactly do these ratings measure?
They measure one thing and one thing only, default risk, which is also known as credit risk. That is the entire scope of a bond rating.
Let me push back on that, or at least clarify, because people get this wrong all the time. A rating agency does not measure interest rate risk.
No.
They do not measure liquidity risk. If Carl somehow issues a 30-year bond and gets a pristine, perfect AAA rating, Dave might look at that and say, wow, it's AAA, it's the safest investment on earth, I can't lose money. But if interest rates spike the next day, the price of that 30-year AAA bond is going to crater.
Absolutely crater.
The pristine credit rating doesn't build a magic force field against interest rate changes.
Exactly. If the exam asks what a credit rating does not measure, your answer is interest rate risk, liquidity risk, or market risk. Now, let's look at the actual letter scales, because you simply must memorize the dividing line between investment grade and speculative grade, which is commonly known as junk debt.
This is where investor Ingrid enters the story. Imagine Ingrid standing outside a highly exclusive financial nightclub, right behind a thick red velvet rope. Her firm's compliance manual strictly dictates that she can only buy investment grade bonds. She is legally forbidden from crossing that rope into junk bond territory. So where exactly is the rope?
The dividing line is BBB for Standard & Poor's and Fitch, or BA3 for Moody's.
BA3.
Right. Anything at that level or higher, climbing all the way up to AAA, is investment grade. Anything one notch below that, meaning BB plus or Bay 1 and lower, is speculative grade, high yield, or junk.
And those terms are interchangeable?
Yes. Those three terms are entirely synonymous on the exam.
Okay, listener, direct question time. Which rating is higher, BBB plus or BBB?
Mm-hmm.
Take a second. It is BBB plus BB. I bring this up because the exam will try to prey on test anxiety to make you think a minus is somehow better, or that BBB plus is the lowest investment grade. It is not. The absolute lowest rung of investment grade is BBB or BA3.
You have to know how the modifiers work.
Yeah.
Standard & Poor's and Fitch use pluses and minuses. Moody's uses numbers 1, 2, and 3, where 1 is the best. So a BA3 is the exact direct equivalent of a BBB.
Right.
It is also crucial to understand the economic dynamic of this velvet rope, because institutional money, pension funds, insurance companies, mutual funds run by Ingrid is often legally barred from buying below that BBB line. The demand for bonds above the line is massive.
So Carl wants to be above the line.
Everyone does. The cost of borrowing is relatively cheap for those companies. But the moment a bond slips below that line, it loses access to that gigantic pool of institutional capital.
Which brings us to one of the most dramatic events in the bond market. Let's progress Carl's story. By some miracle, Carl actually secures a BBB rating for his sushi car wash bonds. He is barely investment grade, but he made it.
Just barely.
Ingrid's compliance team clears it, and she buys a huge $10 million chunk for her fund. But 6 months later, disaster strikes. Turns out, the AI software misidentified a customer's convertible top as a giant slab of tuna.
Yeah.
The resulting lawsuit just ruins Carl's financials. The ratings agencies do an emergency review and downgrade his bond one single notch, from BBB to BB plus plenner. What just happened to Carl's bond?
Carl's bond just officially became a fallen angel.
A fallen angel.
That is the industry term for a bond that was originally issued at investment grade, but has since fallen down into junk territory.
And what happens to the market price of a fallen angel? It doesn't just dip slightly to reflect the new rating. It absolutely craters. It falls off a cliff. Mm. But why? The actual business didn't go bankrupt overnight.
It crashes because of investor Ingrid. Remember her compliance manual?
Mm-hmm.
It explicitly says she cannot hold junk bonds. The second that downgrade hits the wire, she is forced to sell.
Immediately.
She cannot hold it and wait for a recovery. She has no choice. And she is not alone. Hundreds of other institutional managers are hitting the sell button at the exact same millisecond.
It is a complete stampede for the exits.
Precisely. This massive, coordinated institutional dumping creates an artificial supply glut in the market, causing the price of the bond to plummet far beyond what the actual incremental change in credit risk would justify.
Oh, wow.
The exam tests whether you understand this chain reaction. The downgrade to junk triggers forced institutional selling, which triggers a disproportionate price drop.
Okay, so Carl is reeling. He realizes that issuing unsecured debt with his shaky business model is getting too difficult. His bonds are way too risky for Ingrid, and Desperate Dave is getting nervous and demanding huge yields. Carl decides he needs to offer different flavors of bonds, maybe offer some hard collateral to make the lenders feel safe. Let's transition into secured versus unsecured bonds.
Good pivot. A secured bond is backed by specific physical assets or financial collateral. If Carl defaults on his payments, the bondholders have a legal priority claim to those specific assets. They can seize them and sell them to recoup their money. This gives secured bondholders the highest priority in bankruptcy proceedings. The three main types you will see are mortgage bonds, collateral trust bonds, and equipment trust certificates, or ETCs.
Mortgage bonds are intuitive. They are backed by real estate. land, buildings, the actual physical car wash structures. Collateral trust bonds are backed by a portfolio of other securities. Like, if Carl owned millions in shares of a highly successful, normal car wash company, he could put those shares in a vault and pledge them as collateral.
Exactly.
But let's look at equipment trust certificates, because they are incredibly unique. I like to think of ETCs as airplane repo men.
That is a very vivid and accurate way to conceptualize them. ETCs are heavily used by the transportation sector. So airlines, railroads, trucking companies. They use them to finance physical, movable equipment like planes and locomotives.
Movable being the key word.
Yes. The key mechanism here is that the trustee actually holds the legal title to the equipment until the bond is fully paid off.
So if a major airline issues an ETC to buy a fleet of planes, and then they stop paying the bond interest, the trustee literally walks onto the tarmac, changes the locks on the Boeing 747s, and immediately leases or sells them to a rival airline.
Right then and there.
Because the equipment is highly standardized, easily transferable, and holds its value well, ETCs are considered incredibly safe corporate bonds.
They are among the safest. The exam might try to trick you into thinking they are highly risky because they deal with depreciating assets.
Hmm.
I mean, planes get older and less valuable every year.
Right.
But the financing is structured brilliantly. It usually uses a serial maturity, meaning a portion of the debt is paid off every single year, ensuring that the loan balance pays down faster than the equipment depreciates. The collateral is always worth more than the remaining debt.
But what if Carl doesn't have airplanes, he doesn't own the land his car washes are on, and he has no other stocks to pledge? He just issues a bond based on a promise to pay. That is an unsecured bond, right?
Yes, and the formal, highly testable term for an unsecured corporate bond is a debenture. It is backed by nothing more than the issuer's general creditworthiness and their good faith ability to pay.
If I am writing the test, here's my trap. Debenture sounds incredibly fancy. It sounds like a complex, highly secure, ironclad British financial instrument.
It really does.
But it literally just means unsecured. It does not inherently mean safe. But wait, let me push back on my own point here. Does debenture inherently mean risky?
Not at all. And this raises a fundamental question that students constantly miss on practice exams. Which is safer, a secured bond or a debenture? The answer is it depends entirely on the financial strength of the issuer. Right. A debenture issued by a secured mortgage bond with billions in cash, like Microsoft or Johnson & Johnson, is vastly safer than a secured mortgage bond issued by Carl's failing B-rated sushi car wash.
Makes total sense.
The collateral only matters if the company defaults. If the company is a cash-generating machine that will never default, the unsecured debenture is a perfectly safe investment.
So the term debenture really just dictates your place in line in bankruptcy court. If everything goes to zero, secured bond holders get to eat first. Then senior debenture holders.
Yeah.
Then subordinated debentures who willingly took a lower priority for a higher yield. Then preferred stockholders. And finally, common stockholders get whatever crumbs are left on the floor.
Exactly. Now, sticking with the theme of bankruptcy, let's look at a very strange outlier in the bond world. The income bond, which is also sometimes called an adjustment bond. These are almost exclusively issued when a company is already in massive financial distress, usually as they are emerging from Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization.
Okay, so let's say Carl's company actually goes bankrupt. The lawsuits were too much. In the restructuring process, he issues income bonds to his old creditors to replace their old debt. How do these weird things work?
The mechanism of an income bond is right in the name. Carl only has to pay the interest if the company earns sufficient net income to cover it. The interest payments are not strictly guaranteed on a set schedule like a normal bond. If he makes money, he pays. If he doesn't, he doesn't.
Okay, listener, direct question for you. Think carefully about the mechanics we just discussed. If Carl skips a semi-annual interest payment on an income bond because the car wash didn't make any money this quarter, does he officially trigger a default? Take a beat? No. He does not default. That is the magic trick of the income bond. Skipping the payment is entirely allowed under the legal terms of the indenture.
Yes.
It gives the struggling company desperately needed breathing room to try and turn things around.
Yeah, because the timing and reality of these interest payments are so wildly uncertain, income bonds trade flat.
Trade flat.
Trading flat is a crucial exam term. It means they trade without accrued interest. Usually when you buy a normal bond in the middle of a six-month cycle, you have to pay the seller for the interest they've earned up to that exact day. With income bonds, because you don't even know if the next payment is actually going to happen, you do not pay accrued interest. Bonds that are already in default also trade flat.
Okay, so our retail investor, Desperate Dave, is getting completely overwhelmed. He doesn't want to worry about Carl going bankrupt. He doesn't want to worry about reinvesting coupons every 6 months and dealing with that seesaw risk we talked about. Dave throws his hands up and says, just give me a bond where I put in a little bit of money right now. I forget about it and I get a big chunk of money way later. I do not want to deal with coupons.
Dave is describing a zero coupon bond. As the name implies, the stated coupon rate is literally 0%. There are absolutely no semi-annual interest payments. Instead, the bond is issued at a deep, deep discount to its par value.
How deep?
Well, Dave might buy the bond today for $600, hold it for 20 years, and at maturity, he receives the full $1,000 par value. His entire return on investment is that $400 difference.
This bond represents the absolute extremes of bond risks. Let's break down the why here, because if you understand the why, you don't have to memorize anything. Let's look at the seesaw again. Because there are no semi-annual coupons, Dave receives zero cash flow during the life of the bond. So what is his reinvestment risk?
Mathematically, it is zero. You cannot have reinvestment risk if you have no cash flows to reinvest.
Right.
Dave doesn't care what market rates do over the next 20 years because he has no money to put into them anyway.
But on the flip side of the seesaw, what about interest rate risk? Dave is locking up his $600, and he has to wait the entire 20 years to see a single dime of cash flow.
Because all of the cash flow is weighted at the absolute very end of the bond's life, a zero coupon bond has the longest duration. And in finance, longest duration means maximum price volatility.
Huge price swings.
Huge. If interest rates change in the broader market, the secondary market price of Dave's zero coupon bond is going to swing violently up and down compared to a normal bond that pays regular coupons.
Pattern interrupt. I want you to visualize the extremes here. Zero coupons have zero reinvestment risk, but maximum interest rate risk. I will say it again. Zero reinvestment risk, maximum interest rate risk. The exam loves to test this inverse extreme. Do not get them flipped in your head.
Let's shift the story back to Carl. Carl has reorganized his company, and he hates paying these high interest rates to borrow money. He is brainstorming in his office, and he comes up with a hybrid hack.
Uh-oh.
He calls Dave and says, listen, I will pay you a much lower interest rate on this new bond. But T-year, I am pivoting the business entirely to AI. If my company suddenly becomes the next big tech unicorn and explodes in value, I will give you the contractual right to trade this bond in for actual shares of my common stock.
Carl just invented the convertible bond. This is heavily tested and it is very math heavy, so we are going to walk through it step by step. Let's unpack the mechanics.
A convertible bond gives the bondholder, that's Dave, the right to convert the debt instrument into a fixed number of shares of the issuer's common stock. The most important rule here, and a very frequent exam trap, is understanding who holds the power. The conversion is always at the bondholder's option.
Dave's option.
Yes. Carl cannot legally force Dave to convert just because Carl wants him to. It is an immense advantage for Dave, which is exactly why Dave is willing to accept a much lower coupon rate. He is essentially paying for that equity option via a lower yield on the bond.
So how does Dave know how many shares he gets? He doesn't just guess. He has to calculate the conversion ratio. The formula is beautifully simple. Par value divided by the conversion price.
Notice we explicitly use par value in that formula, which is universally $1,000. Does not matter what the current market price of the bond is trading at. You always use $1,000. The indenture will state a fixed conversion price. Let's say it is set at $50.
Okay, listener, do the math with me right now in your head. The par value is always $1,000. The conversion price is $50. How many shares does Dave get if he converts? Take a beat. 1,000 divided by 50. He gets 20 shares. That is his conversion ratio. And that ratio is locked in stone. It's fixed at issuance, unless there is a stock split or a stock dividend, in which case it adjusts proportionately to prevent Dave from being diluted.
Now we enter the concept of parity. Parity simply means equality. It is the theoretical point where the mathematical value of the bond is perfectly identical to the value of the stock you could convert it into.
Huh.
It is the break-even point on the scale.
Let's do another direct question to really lock this in, because the test will make you calculate this. Let's say Carl's AI pivot is a huge success. The stock is soaring. Because the stock is soaring, the bond, which Dave bought, is now trading up in the secondary market at $1,200. We already established Dave's conversion ratio is 20 shares. What is the parity price of the stock? Meaning, what does the stock need to trade at for 20 shares to exactly equal $1,200? Think about the math. You divide the current bond price by the fixed ratio, $1,200 divided by 20 shares. It is $60 a share. If the stock is trading at exactly $60, Dave doesn't care if he holds the bond or the stock. They are both worth exactly $1,200 in his portfolio.
But what if the market gets a little inefficient? What if the bond is trading at $1,200, but the stock is trading at $65? This creates an arbitrage opportunity.
Free money. Arbitrage is the holy grail of finance. It means risk-free profit. Let's walk through the physical act of this arbitrage so you can see why it works. Dave looks at his multi-monitor setup. He sees the bond trading at $1,200. He sees the stock trading at $65. He knows his ratio is 20 shares. If he gets 20 shares and they're worth $65 each, that is $1,300 worth of stock.
So Dave acts immediately. He buys the bond for $1,200, instantly exercises his legal right to convert it into 20 shares of stock, and instantly sells those 20 shares in the open market for $1,300. He just locked in a risk-free profit of $100.
Now, in the real world, Dave isn't fast enough to do this. High-frequency trading algorithms spot this inefficiency and execute it in milliseconds. And think about the market impact of that. Thousands of algorithms are simultaneously buying the bond, which drives the bond price up, and they are simultaneously selling the stock, which drives the stock price down. They will do this until the price is made perfectly back at parity and the free money disappears.
Exactly.
But you need to understand the underlying mechanics for the exam.
The exam will also try to trick you with a concept called forced conversion.
Oh, this is the ultimate trap. Because we just said, very loudly, that conversion is purely at the bondholder's option. Carl cannot legally force Dave to convert. So what on earth is a forced conversion?
It is an economic mechanism, not a legal mandate. Let's say Carl's convertible bond also has a call feature. A call feature means Carl is allowed to call the bond back, essentially forcing Dave to sell it back to him for a preset price. Let's say the call price is $1,050.
Okay, so Carl's stock is doing great. He wants to get this debt off his book, so he triggers the call feature. He says, Dave, here is $1,050. Give me my bond back.
But Dave looks at the market. The stock is soaring. The conversion value of the bond, meaning the 20 shares he would get if he converted right now, is currently worth $1,200. Dave is faced with a choice. He can accept the call, surrender the bond, and take $1,050 in cash from Carl.
Gross.
Or he can exercise his conversion privilege right before the call date, take the 20 shares, and have $1,200 worth of stock.
Dave isn't forced by law to convert. He is forced by math. A rational human being takes $1,200 over $1,050 every single time.
Exactly. The issuer uses the call feature to economically compel the bondholders to convert their debt into equity. This wipes the debt off Carl's balance sheet without Carl actually having to spend cash to pay him off.
Wow.
That is the genius of forced conversion.
Amazing. Okay, so Dave has been trading wildly. He has all these different bonds in his portfolio now. Some he bought at a premium because they had high coupons. Some he bought at a discount. Some are callable. Some aren't. He is staring at his brokerage statements and trying to figure out his actual true return. How does he measure his yield?
This is where we introduce the yield ladder. This is a visual concept you should literally draw out on your scratch paper the moment you sit down in the testing center. There are four main yields you need to rank from highest to lowest depending on the bond's price. Nominal yield, current yield, yield to maturity, or YPM, and yield to call, or YTC.
Let's define those quickly before we rank them. Nominal yield is just the coupon rate. It never changes. It's printed on the metaphorical certificate. 4% is 4%. Current yield is your annual interest divided by the current market price of the bond. It is basically just your dividend yield. YTM is your total annualized return if you hold it to the very last day, factoring in interest, price gains, price losses, and the time value of money. And YTC is your total return if the bond gets called away early by the issuer.
Now, how do these rank depending on whether you bought the bond at a premium or a discount? We have a memory aid. Discount climbs, premium dips.
Let's repeat this because it is massive. Discount climbs, premium dips. Let's visualize the premium bond first. Dave bought a bond for $1,100. It is a premium bond. Because premium dips, the yields go down as you move across the ladder. The highest yield is nominal. Then it dips down to current. Then it dips down to YTM. And the lowest possible yield at the bottom of the ladder is YTC. Nominal is greater than current, which is greater than YTM, which is greater than YTC.
But why is YTC the lowest for a premium bond? If you understand the logic, you don't have to blindly memorize the acronym. Dave paid $1,100 for a bond that will only return the $1,000 par value at the end. He is mathematically guaranteed to take a $100 capital loss.
Right. He overpaid for the high coupon.
If the bond matures in 10 years, Dave has 10 full years to spread out and absorb that $100 loss against his high interest payments. It only hurts his annualized return a little bit each year. But if the bond gets called away in just 2 years, he takes that full $100 loss almost immediately. It brutally crushes his annualized return because he has no time to absorb it. Because early redemption gives him less time to absorb the capital loss, it is his worst-case scenario. Therefore, yield to call is mathematically the lowest.
That makes total sense. It's about the speed of the loss. And for a discount bond, the ladder climbs. Nominal is the lowest at the bottom, then it climbs up to current, then YTM, and YTC is at the very top. Why? Let's use the same logic. If Dave buys a bond for $900, he has a baked-in $100 capital gain waiting for him at par. If he holds it for 10 years, that gain is spread out. But if the bond gets called early in 2 years, he gets that $100 profit incredibly fast, supercharging his annualized return. So YTC is his absolute best case scenario.
This brings us to a highly testable specific regulatory term, yield to worst. SEC rules dictate that when a broker quotes a yield to a retail client on a callable bond, they must quote the worst possible scenario. It is a strict investor protection rule to prevent brokers from overpromising returns.
Okay, let's apply the rule. If Dave is looking at a premium callable bond, what is his yield to worst?
As we just established visually on the ladder, for a premium bond, the lowest yield is yield to call. Because the bond is trading at a premium, it means market rates have fallen. Therefore, the issuer is highly incentivized to call the bond to refinance at those new lower rates. Dave will almost certainly suffer that worst case early call scenario. Therefore, for a premium callable bond, yield to worst equals yield to call.
But what if Dave is looking at a discount callable bond?
For a discount bond, the ladder climbs. YTC is the highest, best case scenario. But think about the issuer's motivation. If the bond is trading at a discount, it means market interest rates have gone up. The issuer has absolutely zero incentive to call the bond and refinance at a higher rate. That would be financial suicide.
Yeah.
They're going to let the bond ride all the way to maturity. So the worst case realistic scenario for the investor is holding it to maturity. Therefore, for a discount callable bond, yield to worst equals yield to maturity.
You just have to remember that yield to worst is literally just the lowest possible yield on your ladder. Find the bottom rung, and that is your answer. Okay, so Dave has figured out his yields. He navigated the seesaw. He actually made some money. But just as he is celebrating, the door gets kicked open. It's the IRS. They want their cut. Let's talk about the tax treatment of corporate debt.
The basic baseline rule is simple. The semi-annual coupon payments Dave receives from Carl's corporate bond are taxed as ordinary income at the federal, state, and local levels. But the exam isn't going to spend much time testing you on the simple stuff. They are going to test you on the weird stuff. Let's go back to Dave's zero coupon bond.
Oh boy. Dave bought it for $600. It matures in 20 years for $1,000. Dave is sitting there thinking, great, I'll pay a capital gains tax on that $400 profit 20 years from now.
Dave is very, very wrong.
Mm.
And this is where people get burned. This is the concept of original issue discount, or OID. The IRS looks at that $400 difference, not as a deferred capital gain, but as interest that was just baked into the initial price. And the IRS does not want to wait 20 years to collect tax on interest. They want to tax it every single year.
If I'm taking the exam, this is exactly where I'm looking for the phrase phantom income.
Precisely. That $400 discount is mathematically divided up over the life of the bond and creates, which simply means it gains book value annually. If it's a 20-year bond, roughly $20 a year is treated as earned interest. Dave will literally receive a 1099 form in the mail saying he earned $20 of interest, and he has to pay ordinary income tax on it this year, even though he did not receive a single penny in cash.
Wait, I have to stop you there because that is infuriating. The mechanism here is that the IRS views the discount as if Carl handed Dave a $20 coupon, and Dave instantly handed it back to Carl to hold for him until maturity. So Dave pays tax on money he hasn't gotten yet. Because of this phantom income, where is the absolute only logical place Dave should hold a zero coupon bond?
In a tax-deferred account, like a traditional IRA or a 401k. Inside those sheltered accounts, the phantom income still technically accretes, but it is shielded from immediate taxation. You don't have to pull cash out of your pocket to pay tax on phantom money.
Now let's look at the back end of this. Because Dave is paying taxes on this phantom income every year out of pocket, the IRS isn't going to double tax him at the end. So what happens to his cost basis?
Every year that he accretes that phantom income and pays tax on it, his official cost basis adjusts UP. It starts at $600. After year one, his basis is $620. After year two, it is $640. By the time it matures at $1,000 in year 20, his adjusted cost basis has accreted to exactly $1,000. So when he receives the $1,000 check at maturity, there is zero capital gain to report.
Okay, I want to compare this to another scenario. What if Dave didn't buy an OID zero coupon bond? What if he bought a regular interest-paying bond in the secondary market, but he bought it at a premium? Say he paid $1,050.
In that case, Dave can choose to amortize that premium. Amortization is the exact mathematical opposite of accretion. Instead of adjusting his cost basis up, it adjusts his cost basis down to bullion over the life of the bond.
Let's walk through that mechanism so it makes sense. Dave paid $50 extra for the bond. Let's say he has 10 years until maturity. So he amortizes, or spreads out, that $50 premium at a rate of $5 a year.
Exactly. And the benefit here is that Dave uses that $5 a year to actively reduce his taxable interest income. So if the bond normally pays him $50 in interest, he subtracts the $5 amortization, and he only pays income tax on $45. It is a tax break today. But in exchange for that tax break, now his cost basis is adjusting downward by $5 a year. By the time the bond matures, his basis has dropped from $1,050 down to $1,000. So when he gets his $1,000 par value back, he has no capital loss to claim.
Let's do a direct comparison to lock this in. OID accretion on zero coupon bonds adjusts your basis UP, and it is mandatory phantom income. You have no choice. Secondary market premium amortization adjusts your basis DWN, giving you a tax break on interest. And for corporate bonds, it is optional. Dave doesn't have to amortize if he doesn't want to.
But what if Dave buys a bond in the secondary market at a discount? Let's say the bond was originally issued at par years ago, but interest rates rose, so Dave buys it today from someone else for $900.
Okay, listener, direct question to you. Think this through. Dave buys the bond at $900 in the secondary market. He holds it to maturity. He gets his $1,000 par value. Is that $100 profit taxed at the favorable capital gains rate? Take a second. No. It is absolutely not. This is a massive exam trap. Market discount is taxed as ordinary income at maturity. The IRS treats that secondary market discount as basically a substitute for the interest you didn't get because the coupon was low. It is ordinary income, not capital gains. Lock that mechanism in.
Okay, so let's check back in with Dave. He is getting incredibly frustrated. He is sick of Carl's crazy business risks. He's sick of the IRS hunting him for phantom income, and he's sick of calculating parity. He wants to look at other alternative options. Let's move into the weird stuff. Money markets, foreign debt, and structured products.
Let's start with money markets. Dave says, I want something super short-term and super safe. I just want to park my cash for a few months.
The primary corporate money market instrument you must know is commercial paper. These are short-term, unsecured promissory notes, essentially massive corporate IOUs. They are strictly issued by massive, highly rated investment-grade companies to cover short-term working capital needs. So let's say Carl's company has grown into a titan, but his cash is tied up in inventory, and he just needs $5 million to make payroll next week. He issues commercial paper.
What's the regulatory trap here?
The maximum maturity for commercial paper is 270 days.
Wait, why specifically 270 days? That seems like an incredibly arbitrary number. Why not a year?
It is entirely about bypassing regulation. The Securities Act of 1933 explicitly states that any corporate debt maturing in 270 days or less is completely exempt from SEC registration. Registering a security with the SEC takes months of lawyers and costs millions of dollars. If Carl just needs cash to pay his sushi chefs next week, he cannot wait for SEC approval. So he issues 270-day commercial paper, sells it at a discount to institutional investors, gets his cash today, and bypasses the SEC entirely.
That is a massive loophole. Okay, what about brokered CDs? Dave knows about certificates of deposit from his local retail bank.
Brokered CDs are similar to traditional bank CDs, but they are bought and sold through broker dealers, which means they can actually trade in the secondary market. Because they are ultimately bank products, they carry FDIC insurance up to $250,000.
If I am writing the test, here's my trick question. The FDIC insurance only protects Dave against the underlying bank defaulting and going out of business. If Dave buys a five-year brokered CD, an interest rate spike after 1 year, and Dave decides to sell his CD in the secondary market, the price of his CD will have fallen due to interest rate risk. He will lose money on the sale. The FDIC does not protect you from market risk.
Let's look abroad. Dave wants to diversify his portfolio internationally. He can buy sovereign debt, which is issued by foreign governments, or foreign corporate debt. Both of these add a massive new layer of risk that domestic bonds don't have. Political risk. Foreign governments can abruptly change tax rules, impose capital controls, or simply refuse to pay.
But the big distinction the exam loves to test is between two specific types of foreign bonds, Yankee bonds and Eurodollar bonds. They'll definitely try to confuse these, so let's do a direct side-by-side comparison.
Both Yankee and Eurodollar bonds share one vital characteristic. They're both denominated in U.S. dollars. This is crucial because it means for a U.S. investor like Dave, there is zero currency risk. He doesn't have to worry about the exchange rate between the dollar and the yen fluctuating and wiping out his yield.
But that is where the similarities end. So what exactly is a Yankee bond?
A Yankee bond is issued by a foreign entity, let's say a massive Japanese electronics corporation, but it is sold inside the United States to U.S. investors. Because it is sold inside the U.S., it must jump through all the regulatory hoops and be registered with the SEC.
Okay, so if Yankee means inside the U.S., what is a Euro-dollar bond? My assumption, and I think a lot of people's assumption, is that it has something to do with the European currency, the euro.
That is exactly the misconception the exam preys on. Don't let the euro prefix confuse you. In finance, the prefix euro simply means outside the home country. A euro dollar is literally just a U.S. dollar held in a bank outside the United States. A euro yen is a Japanese yen held outside Japan. So a Eurodollar bond is a bond issued outside the United States, but it still pays its principal and interest in U.S. dollars. Because it is issued outside U.S. borders, it is not registered with the SEC, it is less regulated, and as a quirk, it typically pays interest annually instead of semi-annually.
Let's lock this in with a direct formula. Yen equals SEC registered, sold in the U.S., Eurodollar equals unregistered, sold outside the U.S.,
yeah.
Both equal NO currency risk for Dave.
Finally, Dave's broker pitches him a structured product, specifically an ETN, an exchange-traded note. The broker says, Dave, this is perfect. It trades on an exchange just like an ETF. It's super liquid, and it tracks the S&P 500 index perfectly with absolutely zero tracking error.
This sounds incredible to Dave. No reinvestment risk, perfect tracking. What is the hidden structural danger here? Why are ETNs fundamentally so much more dangerous compared to a standard ETF?
It all comes down to the underlying structure. When you buy an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, the fund manager actually takes Dave's money and physically goes out and buys the 500 stocks in the S&P 500. Those actual shares of stocks sit in a custodial vault. If the company managing the ETF goes totally bankrupt tomorrow, Dave still indirectly owns his little proportional slice of those 500 stocks.
But an ETN?
An ETN has absolutely no underlying portfolio. It doesn't buy any stocks at all. An ETN is simply the unsecured debt of the issuing investment bank. It is quite literally a napkin IOU. The bank says, give us your money today, and in 10 years, we promise to pay you a return equal to whatever the S&P 500 did, minus our fees.
So it has zero tracking error because they're just doing math on a spreadsheet. There are no actual stocks to buy or sell. But the exam trap here is massive. ETNs have extreme credit risk. If that issuing bank fails, think of Lehman Brothers in 2008. The ETN investors are just unsecured creditors holding a worthless IOU. Even if the S&P 500 tripled in value during that time, Dave gets nothing because the bank defaulted. ETFs have market risk, but no credit risk. ETNs carry the massive credit risk of the issuer. Lock that distinction down.
We have covered incredible ground today. From the absolute basics of par value through the velvet rope of ratings, all the way to the exotic credit dangers of ETNs.
Pattern interrupt. Take a breath, shake it out, stretch your neck. We are moving into the conclusion. We are going to do a rapid fire recap of the absolute most testable concepts we just covered. I will start. BBB or Baby 3 is the absolute lowest investment grade rating, one notch lower, and you have a fallen angel, which triggers massive institutional forced selling.
Zero coupon bonds have maximum interest rate risk, zero reinvestment risk, and produce annual phantom income that must accrete upwards for tax purposes.
The convertible bond ratio is par value divided by the conversion price. It always uses the fixed $1,000 par, not the fluctuating market price, and the ratio is fixed at issuance.
For a premium bond, the yields dip down the ladder. Nominal is greater than current, which is greater than YTM, which is greater than YTC. YTC is the lowest because the capital loss happens faster and crushes the annualized return.
Yankee bonds are SEC registered in the U.S. Eurodollar bonds are unregistered outside the U.S. Both are paid in dollars and eliminate currency risk for U.S. investors.
And finally, ETNs are unsecured debt instruments with severe issuer credit risk, while ETFs hold actual physical assets and do not have issuer credit risk.
Boom! That is the core of Function 3 corporate bonds. But before we sign off, we always like to leave you with a provocative thought, something to chew on that goes beyond just answering multiple choice questions.
We talked extensively about investor Ingrid and how institutional investors are forced by their own compliance rules to dump a bond the exact second it drops from BBB to BB Plus and becomes a fallen angel. I want you to think about the massive market inefficiency that creates. You have a financial asset where the price is tanking artificially, purely due to strict regulatory constraints on the buyers, not just because the underlying business is completely doomed.
Right. If Carl's car wash just had one bad quarter because of a weird AI glitch, but his long-term business outlook is actually totally fine, the price of his bond still crashes just as hard because Ingrid legally has to sell.
Exactly. For an unregulated retail investor like Dave, someone who is not bound by a velvet rope, someone who can do their own deep credit analysis and spot an overreaction, a fallen angel during a market panic might just be the greatest, most asymmetric discount buying opportunity in the entire fixed income market. The rules that bind the institutions create the opportunity for everyone else.
Buying the panic, I absolutely love it, because at the end of the day, whether it is a pristine AAA debenture from Microsoft or a junk-rated secured bond backing a drive-through sushi car wash, the corporate bond market isn't just about math and indentures. It is about finding the hidden opportunities when the rest of the market is forced to look the other way. And now you know exactly how the mechanics work to navigate it. Keep studying, keep doing the practice questions, and you will absolutely crush this deep dive into the Series 7.